Star Tide Rising, Cassette 6.
Chapter 36. Aki. Hurrying to get to the bridge before watch change, Aki took a shortcut through the outlock. In his haste, he was halfway across the wide chamber before he noticed anything different. He did an overhead flip to stop. His gill lungs heaved, and he cursed himself for an idiot, speeding and doing fancy maneuvers when there just wasn't enough oxygen available. The outlock was as empty as he had ever seen it. The captain's gig had been lost at the shallow cluster. Heavy sleds and a lot of equipment had been moved to the Thenanin wreck, and Lieutenant Hikahi had taken the skiff there only yesterday. There was a cluster of activity around the longboat, the last and largest of Streaker's pinnaces. Several crewmen used mechanical spiders to carry crates into the small spacecraft. Aki forgot his haste to be early on duty and kicked a lazy spiral toward the activity. He swam up behind one spider riding dolphin. The finned spider carried a large box in its Waldo arms.
"Hey, Seppa, what's going on here?"
Aki kept his sentences short and simple. He was getting better speaking Anglic in Oxywater, but if a Calafian couldn't speak properly, what were the others to think? The other dolphin looked up.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Aki. Change of orders is what? We're checking the longboat for spaceworthiness. Also, we've been told to load these crates."
"What are they? What's in the boxes?"
"Dr. Metz's records, seems."
The spider's third manipulator arm waved toward the pile of waterproof cartons.
"Imagine all our grandparents and grandchildren here listed on mag chips. It gives you a feeling of continuity, don't it?"
Suppa was from the South Atlantic community, a clan which took pride in quaint speech. Aki wondered if it were really eccentricity as much as plain dimness.
"I thought you were on the supply run to the Thenanin ship," he asked.
Suppa was usually assigned tasks that required minimal finesse.
"That I were, Mr. Aki, but those runs have been stopped. The ship's closed down, didn't you hear? We're all swimming in circles till it's clearer about the captain's condition."
"What?" Aki choked. "The captain?"
"Got hurt in an inspection outside the ship. Electrocuted, I hear. Barely found him before his breather ran out. Been unconscious all this time. Takata Jim's in charge."
Aki lay there in shock. He was too stunned to notice Suppa turn suddenly and hurry back to work as a very large dark figure swam up.
"May I help you, Mr. Aki?"
The giant dolphin's tone sounded almost sarcastic.
"Kathajan,"
Aki shook himself.
"What's happened to the captain?"
Something in the bosun's attitude chilled Aki. And it wasn't just the minimal pretense of respect for Aki's rank. Kathad John let out a quick squirt of trinary. "Suggestions come to me, how you can know more. Go and ask your leader, who awaits you on the shore." With an almost insolent wave of one harness arm, Kathad John flipped about and swam off to rejoin his work crew. The wake from his mighty flukes pushed Aki backward 2 meters. Aki knew better than to call him back. Something in Kathad John's trinary triple entendre told him it would be useless. He decided to take it as a warning and turned to hurry toward the hull lift. He was suddenly aware of how many of the best Fen in Streaker's crew were absent. Tisht, Hikahi, Karkate, Stat, and Lucky Ka were all gone to the Thenanin wreck. That left Kathad John, senior petty officer. And Kipiru was away as well. Aki hadn't believed the gossip he had heard about the pilot. He had always thought Kipiru the bravest Finn in the crew, besides the fastest swimmer. He wished Kipiru and Toshio were here right now. They'd help him find out what was going on. Near the lift, Aki encountered a group of four Tersiops, clustered in a corner of the outlock, doing nothing in particular. They wore morose expressions and lay in listless postures.
Susta, what's going on here? He asked. Don't you Fen have work to do?
The messman looked up and twisted his tail in the dolphin's equivalent of a shrug.
What's the point, Mr. Aki? The point is we do our duty. Come on, what's got you all in such a funk?
The captain, one of the others began.
Aki cut him off.
The captain would be the first to say you should persevere.
He switched to trinary. Focus on the far horizon, on Earth, where we are needed.
Susta blinked and tried to drop his forlorn stance. The others followed suit.
Yes, sir, Mr. Aki, we'll try.
Aki nodded.
Very good, then. Carry on in the spirit of Kinnik.
He entered the lift and clicked out a code for the bridge. As the doors slid shut, he saw the Fen swim away, presumably toward their workstations.
Ifni. It had been hard to posture and act reassuring when all he really wanted to do was squeeze the others for information. But in order to be reassuring, he had to seem to know more than they. Turtle bites. Dysfunctioning motors. How badly is the captain hurt? How will we stand a chance if Krydike is taken from us?
He decided to be as innocuous and unnoticed as possible for a while, until he found out what was going on. He knew Amidi was in the most exposed position of all, with an officer's burdens and none of the protections. And Amidi was always the last to find out what was going on.
Chapter 37 Suessi. The excavation was nearly ready. The Thenanin battleship had been reamed and braced. Soon they'd be able to fill the cylindrical cavity with its intended cargo and be off. Hannes Suessi couldn't wait. He'd had it with working underwater. If the truth be told, he'd about had it with fins, too. Gads, the stories he would be able to tell back home. He had bossed work gangs under the smog oceans of Titan. He had helped herd adenine comets through the Soup Nebula. He had even worked with those crazy Amerindians and Israelis who were trying to terraform Venus. But never had a job taught him the laws of perversity as this one had. Almost all of the materials they'd had to work with were of alien manufacture, with weird ductility and even stranger quantum conductivities. He'd had to check the psionic impedance of almost every connection himself, and still their masked marvel would probably leak telekinetic static all over the sky when it took off. Fins. They were the frosting. They'd flawlessly perform the most delicate operation, then swim about in circles squealing primal nonsense when the opening of a hatchway set off a peculiar pattern of sonar reflections. And every time a job was finished, they called for old Suessi. "Check it for us, Hannes," they'd ask. "Make sure we've done it right." They tried so damned hard. They couldn't help feeling like half-finished clients of wolfling patrons in an impossibly hostile galaxy, especially when it was all true. Suessi admitted he was bitching more to hear the echoes in his own skull than out of any real complaint. The Streakers had done the job. That was all that really mattered. He was proud of every one of them. Anyway, it had been a lot better since Hikahi arrived. She provided an example for the rest, teasing with Kinnik parables to help the Fen concentrate. Suessi rolled over onto one elbow. His narrow bunk was only a meter below the ceiling. inches from his shoulder was the horizontal hatch to his coffin-like sleeper compartment. "I've rested enough," he thought, though his eyes were scratching and his arms still ached. There was no sense in trying to go back to sleep. He would only stare at his eyelids now. Suessi pushed the narrow hatch open. He shielded his eyes from the overhead lights of the companionway as he sat up and swung his legs over the side. They splashed. Water. Except for the top meter or so up here near the ceiling, the skiff was full of water. His body looked pale in the sharp hall light. "I wonder when I'm scheduled to fade away," he thought, sliding into the water with his eyes closed. He swam over to the head and closed the door behind him. Naturally, he had to wait until the room pumped out before he could use any of the fixtures. A little later, he made his way to the control room of the tiny spacecraft. Hikahi was there with Tisht, fussing over the comm set. They argued in a fast, squeaky version of Anglic he couldn't follow.
"Whoa!" he called. "If you want to keep me out, fine, but if I can help, you'd better change to 33 1/3. I'm not Tom Orley. I can't follow that jabber."
The two dolphin officers lifted their heads clear of the water as Suessi took a grip on a nearby wall rail. Hikahi's eyes extended outward to refocus for above-water binocular vision.
"We aren't sure we have a problem, Hannes, but we seem to have lost contact with the ship."
"With Streaker?"
Suessi's bushy eyebrows went up.
"Are they under attack?"
Tisht rocked her upper body left to right slightly.
"We don't think so. I was here waiting for word that they'd heard from Orley and would be moving the ship soon. I wasn't paying close attention, but heard the operator suddenly tell us to stand by, then nothing."
"When was this?"
"A few hours ago. I waited until shift change, hoping it was a technical glitch at the ship. And then I called Hikahi." "We've been tracing circuits since then,"
the senior officer finished. Suessi swam over to look at the set. Of course, the thing to do was tear it apart and check it by hand, but the electronics were sealed away against the wetness. If only we were in free fall so the fins could work without all this damned water everywhere.
"All right," he sighed. "With your permission, Hikahi, I'll kick you two officers and gentle femmes out of the control room and look at the unit. And don't bother the fen resting in the hold."
Hikahi nodded.
"I'll send a crew to follow the monofilament and see if it's intact."
"Good thinking. And don't worry, I'm sure nothing's really the matter. It's probably just gremlins at work."
Chapter 38 Charles Dart.
"I'm afraid they've only taken the damned robot down another 80 meters. That kid Toshio will only work on it for a few hours. Then he's always got to be off helping Denny and Jillian run their new clients through mazes or having them knock down bananas with poles or something. I tell you, it's frustrating. The rotten little half-wrecked probe's carrying mostly the wrong kinds of instruments for geological work. Can you imagine how bad it will be when we get it down to a decent depth?"
Holographic image of the metallurgist Brukida seemed to look past Charles Dart for a moment. Apparently the dolphin scientist was referring to his own displays. Each eye was covered with a goggle lens to correct for astigmatism when reading. He turned back to look at his chimp colleague.
"Charlie, you talk so assuredly about sending this robot deeper into Kithrop's crust. You complain that it has gone down only 500 meters. Are you cognizant that that is half a kilometer?"
Charlie scratched his fuzzy jaw.
"Yeah? So what? The excavation has got so little taper that it might easily drop down as much farther as it's already gone. It's a wonderful mineralogical lab. Already I'm finding out a lot about the subsurface zone.
Brukita sighed.
Charlie, aren't you curious as to why the cavern under Toshio's island goes down even 100 meters?
What do you mean?
I mean that the so-called drill tree that's responsible for this excavation cannot have dug so deep merely in search of carbon and silicate nutrients. It can't have.
How would you know? Are you an ecologist?
Charlie rapped out a sharp laugh.
Honestly, Brukita, what do you base these suppositions on? Sometimes you surprise me.
Brukita waited patiently for the chimpanzee to finish laughing.
I base them on a well-informed layman's knowledge of basic laws of nature and upon Occam's razor. Think of the volume of material removed. Has it been scattered upon the waters? Has it occurred to you that there are tens of thousands of these metal mounds along this plate boundary, most with their own drill trees, and that there may have been millions of such deep excavations dug in recent geologic time?
Dart started to snigger, then he stopped. He stared for a moment at the image of his cetacean colleague, then laughed in earnest. He pounded the desk.
Touché! All right, sir. We'll add, why these holes, to our list of questions. Unfortunately, I've been cultivating an ecologist lab mate for the last few months. I've done her innumerable favors, and it happens she's at the site of our quandary. I'll ask Denny to get to work on it right away. Rest assured, we'll know soon enough what these drill trees are up to.
Brukita didn't bother answering. He did let out a small sigh.
Now that that's settled,
Charlie went on,
let's get back to the really important stuff. Can you help persuade the captain to let me go out there in person and take a real deep probe robot with me to replace that lousy little thing Toshio salvaged?
Brukita's eyes widened. He hesitated.
The captain remains unconscious, Brukita said at last. McKinney has twice performed surgery. According to the latest reports, the outlook remains bleak.
The chimp stared for a long moment.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
Charlie looked away from the hollow display.
Well, then maybe Takata Jim will be willing. After all, the longboat's not being used. I'll ask Metz to talk to him. Will you help?
Brukita's eyes were sunken.
I'll study these mass spectrometer data, he answered evenly. I will call you when I have results. Now I must sign off, Charles Dart.
The image dissolved. Charlie was alone again. Brukita was awfully abrupt there, he thought. Have I offended him somehow? Charlie knew he was offensive to people. He couldn't help it. Even other chimpanzees thought him abrasive and self-centered. They said neo-chimps like him gave the race a bad rep. Well, I've tried, he thought. And when a person's tried and failed so often, when his best attempts at gallantry turn to faux pas, and he constantly finds himself forgetting other people's names, well, then maybe a guy should give up. Other people don't always win awards for kindness to me, either. Charles Dart shrugged. It didn't matter. What point was there in pursuing an ever-elusive popularity? There was always his personal world of rocks and molten cores, of magma and living planets. Still, I thought Brukita, at least, was my friend. He forced the thought aside. I've got to call Metz. He'll get me what I need. I'll show him this planet is so unique, they'll rename it after me. There are precedents. He chuckled as he tugged on his ear with one hand and punched out a code with the other. An idle thought came to him, as he waited for the computer tracer to track down Ignacio Metz. Wasn't everybody waiting to hear from Tom Worley? That was all anybody'd talk about a while back. Then he remembered that Orley's report was supposed to come in yesterday, about the time Krydike was hurt. Ah. Then Tom was probably successful at whatever it was he was doing, and nobody bothered to tell me. Or maybe somebody did, and I wasn't listening again. Anyway, I'm sure he got everything squared away with the ETs. About time, too. Damn nuisance being hunted all over the galaxy, forced to fill the ship with water. Metz's number appeared on the intercom. The line was ringing. It was a shame about Krydike. He was awfully stiff and serious for a Finn, and not always reasonable. But Charlie couldn't bring himself to feel happy to have him out of the way. In fact, it gave him a queer sensation in his stomach whenever he thought about the captain being removed from the picture. Then don't think about it. Geez, when has it ever paid to worry?
Ah, Dr. Metz, did I catch you as you were going out? I was wondering, could we have a talk together soon? Later this afternoon? Good. Yes, I do have a very... very small favor to ask.
Chapter 39 Mackinay. A physician must be part intellectual and part alchemist, part sleuth and part shaman, Mackinay thought. But in medical school, they'd ever told her she might have to be a soldier and politician as well. Mackinay had trouble keeping a dignified demeanor. In fact, she felt on the verge of insubordination. Her tail crashed to the water's surface, sending spray over the canals of sickbay.
"I tell you, I can't operate alone. My aides haven't the skill to assist me. I must talk to Jillian Baskin."
With one eye lazily lifted above the waterline, one harness arm holding a channel stanchion, Takata Jim glanced at Ignacio Metz. The human returned an expression of great patience. They had expected this sort of reaction from the ship's surgeon.
"I'm sure you underrate your skill, Doctor," Takata Jim suggested.
"So you're a surgeon now? I need your opinion. Let me talk to Jillian."
Metz spoke placatingly.
"Doctor, Lieutenant Takata Jim has just explained that there are military reasons for the partial communications blackout. Data from the detection buoys appears to indicate a psi leak somewhere within 100 kilometers of this spot. Either the crew working under Hikahi and Suesi or the people at the island are responsible. Until we trace the leak..."
"You are acting on the basis of information from a buoy? It was a defective buoy that almost killed Krydike."
Metz frowned. He wasn't used to being interrupted by dolphins. He noted that Mackinay was quite agitated, too agitated, in fact, to speak with the Anglic diction a Finn in her position should use. This was certainly data for his files, as was her belligerent attitude.
"That was a different buoy, Physician Mackinay. Remember, we have 3 on station. Besides, we aren't claiming the leak is necessarily real, only that we must treat it as real until proven otherwise."
"But the blackout isn't total. I hear that Chimpanzee is still getting his icky-damned robot data. So why won't you let me talk to Dr. Baskin?"
Metz wanted to curse. He had asked Charles Dart to keep quiet about that. Damn the necessity to keep the chimp placated.
"We are eliminating the possibilities one at a time," Takata Jim tried to soothe Mackinay.
At the same time, he assumed a head-down forward stance, dominant, assertive body language. "As soon as those in contact with Charles Dart, the young humans Iwashika and Sudman and the poet Shout have been eliminated as possible leaks, then we will contact Dr. Baskin. Surely you see that she is less likely to be the one carelessly leaking psi energy than these others, so we must check them first. Metz's eyebrows rose slightly. Bravo. The excuse wouldn't hold up under close scrutiny, of course, but it had a flavor of reasonability. All they needed was a little time. If this kept McKinney quiet for just another couple of days, that should be enough. Takata Jim apparently noticed something of Metz's approval. Encouraged, he grew more assertive. Now, enough delaying, Doctor. We came down here to find out about the captain's condition. If he's unable to resume his duties, a new commanding officer must be selected. We're in a crisis and cannot put up with delays. If this was meant to intimidate, it had the opposite effect. McKinney's tail churned. Her head rose out of the water. She turned one narrowed eye to the male dolphin and chattered in sarcastic verse. I'd thought that you had misremembered duty's orders. How nice to note I had mistaken your behavior. You'll not claim, in hasty mischief, captain's honors? Takata Jim's mouth opened, bearing twin V rows of rough white teeth. For a moment it seemed to Metz he would charge the small female. But McKinney acted first, leaping out of the water and landing with a splash that covered both Metz and Takata Jim. The human spluttered and slipped off the wall curb. McKinney whirled and disappeared behind a row of dark life support coffins. Takata Jim spun underwater, emitting rapid sonar clicks, seeking her out. Met seized him by the dorsal fin before he could take off after her.
Ahem!
He grabbed a wall rail. If we can put a stop to this foul temper, fin people... Dr. McKinney, will you please come back? It's bad enough half the known universe wants to hunt us down. We mustn't fight among ourselves. Takata Jim looked up and saw that Metz was earnest. The lieutenant continued to breathe heavily.
Please, McKinney, Metz called again. Let's talk like civilized folk.
They waited, and a short time later, McKinney's head emerged from between two auto docks. Her expression was no longer defiant, simply tired. Her physician's harness made tiny whirring sounds. The delicate instruments shook slightly, as if held in trembling hands. She rose, so only her blowmouth broke the surface.
I apologize, she buzzed. I know Takata Jim would not assume permanent captaincy without a vote by the ship's council.
Of course he wouldn't. This is not a military vessel. The duties of the executive officer aboard a survey ship are mostly administrative, and his succession to command must be ratified by a ship's council as soon as one can be conveniently arranged. Takata Jim is fully aware of the rules involved. Is that right, Lieutenant?
Yes.
But until then, we must accept Takata Jim's authority or have chaos. And in the meantime, Streaker must have a chain of command. That will be ambiguous until you certify that Captain Krydike can no longer function.
McKinney closed her eyes, breathing heavily.
Krydike will probably not regain consciousness without further surgery. Even then, it's chancy. The shock traveled along his neural connector socket into the brain. Most of the damaged areas are in the new zones of the cortex, where basic tersiops gray matter has been heavily uplift modified. There are lesions in regions controlling both vision and speech. The corpus callosum is seared.
McKinney's eyes reopened, but she did not appear to be looking at them. Metz nodded.
Thank you, Doctor, he said. You've told us what we need to know. I'm sorry we took so much of your time. I'm sure you're doing your best.
When she did not answer, the human slipped his oxy mask over his face and slid into the water. He motioned to Takata Jim and turned to leave. The male dolphin clicked at Makani for a moment longer, but when she did not move, he flipped about and followed Metz toward the exit. A shudder passed through her as the two entered the lock. She lifted her head to call after them.
"Don't forget, when you call a ship's council, that I'm a member, and Hikaki and Jillian and Tom Orley."
The lock was hissing shut behind them as she called. She couldn't tell if they had heard. Makani settled back into the water with a sigh. "And Tom Orley," she thought. "Don't forget him, you sneaky bastards. He'll not let you get away with this." Makani shook her head, knowing she was thinking irrationally. Her suspicions weren't based on facts, and even if they were true, Thomas Orley couldn't stretch his hand across 2,000 kilometers to save the day. There were rumors that he was already dead. Metz and Takata Jim had her all confused. She had a gut feeling that they had told her a complex assortment of truths, half-truths, and outright lies, and she had no way of knowing which was which. "They think they can fool me just because I'm female and old and 2 uplift generations cruder than any other Finn aboard but Brukida. But I can guess why they're giving special favors to the one chimpanzee member of the ship's council. Here and now, they have a majority to back up any decision they make. No wonder they're not anxious to have Hikaki or Jillian back. Maybe I should have lied to them, told them Crydike would awaken any minute. But then, who can tell how desperate they are, or what they'd resort to? Was the accident with the buoy really an accident? They could be lying to cover up ignorance, or to cover up a conspiracy. Could I protect Crydike with only 2 female aides to help me?" Makani let out a low moan. This sort of thing wasn't her department. She sometimes wished that being a dolphin physician, like in the old days, simply meant you lifted the one you were trying to save up on your brow and held his head above the water until he recovered, or your strength failed you, or your own heart broke. She turned back toward intensive care. The chamber was darkened except for a light that shone upon a large gray neo-dolphin suspended in a shielded gravity tank. Makani checked the life maintenance readings and saw that they were stable. Crydike blinked unseeingly, and once a brief shudder passed down the length of his body. Makani sighed and turned away. She swam over to a nearby comm unit and considered. "Metz at Takata Jim can't be back on the bridge yet," she thought. She clicked a sonar code that activated the unit. Almost instantly, the face of a young, blue-finned dolphin appeared before her.
"Communications, can I help you?" "Aki? Yes, child, it's Dr. Makani. Have you made any plans for lunch? You know, I do think I still have some of that candied octopus left. You're free? How sweet. I'll see you soon, then. Oh, and let's keep our date our little secret, okay? That's a good lad."
She departed intensive care, a scheme beginning to form in her mind. Chapter 40 Crydike. In the quiet grayness of the gravity tank, a faint moaning cry. Desperate, he swims, tossed by gray storm winds, howling, drowning, drowning. Chapter 41 Tom Orley. A foul-tempered mountain growled in the middle of a scum-crusted sea. It had stopped raining a while ago. The volcano grumbled and coughed fire at low, overhanging clouds, casting orange on their undersides. Thin, twisting trails of ash blew into the sky. Where the hot cinders finally fell, it was not to a quenching by clean seawater. They landed in a muddy layer atop a carpet of dingy vines, which seemed to go on forever. Thomas Orley coughed in the dank, sooty air. He crawled up a small rise of slippery, jumbled weeds. The dead weight of his crude sledge dragged a tether wrapped around his left hand. With his right, he clutched a thick tendril near the top of the weed mound. His legs kept sliding out from under him as he crawled. Even when he managed to wedge them into gaps in the slimy mass, his feet frequently sank into the mire between the vines. When he awkwardly pulled them out, the quagmire would let go reluctantly, giving off an awful sucking sound. Sometimes things came out with his feet, squirming along his legs and dropping off to slither back into the noisome brine. The tightly wrapped thong cut into his left hand as he pulled the sledge, a meager remnant of his solar plane and supplies. It was a miracle that he had been able to salvage even that much from the crash. The volcano sent ochre flickers across the weedscape. Rainbow specks of metallic dust coated the vegetation in all directions. It was late afternoon, almost a full Kithrib day, since he had banked his glider toward the island, searching for a safe place to land. Tom raised his head to look blearily over the plain of weeds. All of his well-laid plans had been brought down by this plain of tough, ropey sea plants. He had hoped to find shelter on an island upwind of the volcano, or, barring that, to land at sea and turn the glider into a broad and seaworthy raft from which to perform his experiment. I should have considered this possibility. The crash, those dazed, frantic minutes diving after gear and piling together a crude sledge while the storm lashed at him, and then hours crawling among the fetid vines toward a solitary hump of vegetation, it all might have been avoided. He tried to pull forward, but a tremor in his right arm threatened to turn into a full-scale cramp. It had been badly wrenched during the crash, when the plane's wing pontoons had come off and the fuselage went tumbling across the morass, splashing at last into an isolated pool of open water. A gash across the left side of his face had almost sent him into shock during those first critical moments. It reached from his jaw almost to the neural socket above his left ear. The plastic cover that normally protected the delicate nerve interface had spun out into the night, hopelessly lost. Infection was the least of his worries now. The tremor in his arm grew worse. Tom tried to ride it out, lying face down on the pungent, rubbery weeds. Gritty mud scraped his right cheek and forehead each time he coughed. Somewhere he had to find the energy. He hadn't time for the subtleties of self-hypnosis to coax his body back into working. By main force of will, he commanded the abused muscles to behave for one final effort. He could do little about what the universe threw at him, but damn it, after 30 hours of struggle, within meters of his goal, he would not accept a rebellion by his body. Another coughing fit ripped at his raw throat. His body shook, and the hacking weakened his grip on the dry root. Just when he thought his lungs could take no more, the fit finally passed. Tom lay there in the mud, drained, eyes closed. Count the joys of movement, first among advantages, absence of boredom. He hadn't the breath to whistle the trinary haiku, but it blew through his mind, and he spared the energy for a brief smile through cracked, mud-crusted lips. Somewhere he found the reserves for one more effort. He clenched his teeth and pulled himself over the last stretch. The right arm almost buckled, but it held as his head rose over the top of the small hill. Tom blinked cinders from his eyes and looked out at what lay beyond. More weeds. As far as the eye could see, more weeds. A thick loop of Nustatic vine stuck out at the summit of the modest hillock. Tom heaved the sledge high enough to wrap the slack line around the root. Sensation flowed into his numbed left hand, leaving him open-mouthed in silent agony. He slumped back against the hillock, breathing rapidly and shallowly. The cramps returned in force, and his body folded under them. He wanted to tear at the thousand teeth that bit at his arms and legs, but his hands were immobile claws. He lay curled around them. Somehow the logical part of Tom's mind remained disconnected from the agony. It still plotted and schemed and tried to set time limits. He'd come out here for a reason, after all. There had to be a reason for going through all this. If only he could remember why he was here in the stench and hurt and dust and grit. The common pattern he sought wouldn't form. He felt himself starting to fade. Suddenly, through pain-squinted eyes, he thought he saw Jillian's face. Fronds of airy vegetation waved behind her. Her gray eyes looked his way, as if searching for something just out of range. They seemed to scan past him twice as he trembled, unable to move. Then, at last, they met his, and she smiled. Pain-drenched static threatened to drown out the dream words. I send for good, though you skeptical, love, though the whole might listen. He strained to focus on the message, more likely a hallucination. He didn't care which. It was an anchor. He clung to it as cramps made humming bowstrings of his tendons. Her smile conveyed commiseration. What a mess are the I love is and careless. Shall I it better? Meta Orley disapproved. If this really was a message from Jillian, she was taking a terrible chance. I love you too, he sub-vocalized. But will you shut the hell up before the ETs hear you? The psycast, or figment, wavered as a fit of coughing struck, hacking until his lungs felt like dry husks. Finally, he sank back with a sigh. At last, Metatom surrendered pride. Yes. He cast into the murk before his eyes, calling after her dissolving image. Yes, love, please come back and make better. Jillian's face seemed to diffract in all directions, like a bundle of moonbeams joining the shimmering volcanic dust in the sky. Whether a true message or an illusion born of delirium, it faded like a portrait done in smoke. Still, he thought he heard a lingering trace of Jillian's inner voice. Is, that is, and healing comes in dreaming. He listened, unaware of time, and slowly the tremors subsided. His fetal curl gradually unfolded. The volcano rumbled and lit the sky. The ground beneath Tom undulated gently and rocked him into a shallow slumber.
This ends side one of cassette 6.